นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิWell, for those of you who've come this evening and on this observance day, this is the new moon of October. And if you've come this evening to listen to a Dhamma talk and you're wondering why there's a table with a large number of books lined up in front of the shrine, the reason is that yesterday this complete set of the Tipitaka in Pali, printed in Roman script, was presented to Amaravati Monastery. It was actually donated in June in Bangkok, and then the group, the World Tipitaka Foundation, that prepared it and printed it, got it shipped over here, and then it was formally installed, enshrined here in the monastery yesterday. So we thought we'd leave it in place for today, and so that people can appreciate this very kind and generous offering to the community. So this is a complete collection of the Buddha's teaching, the Vinaya, the Suttas, and the Abhidhamma, the three baskets, as they're called, the Tipitaka. Tipitaka means three baskets, the three sections of the Buddha's teaching. So this is the full body of the Pali canon. And we have other editions of this from the Pali Text Society in some large proportion of it. But this is a sort of newly prepared edition and hopefully has a minimum number of mistakes in it. And is offered to be a resource for our community into the future. When we listen to the Dhamma talks of Lumpur Cha and Lumpur Samedo, the elders of our tradition, our particular lineage, especially Lumpur Cha, if you read his Dhamma talks or listen to them, often he'll be encouraging people to put aside the books. When I first showed up at the monastery in northeast Thailand 40 years ago or so, then that was the encouragement, was put away the books, just read your own heart, study the Tipitaka of your own mind. And so that was the sort of standard procedure for Ajahn Chah was in his monasteries, was don't read anything for the next 5 years. In many ways was the standard approach for the forest tradition, was to put aside the books, don't spend your time on academic studies, but train your mind. Watch your mind. Train your mind. Put your attention on the living experience of each moment. And that particular approach grew up in Thailand, it seems, because of a very, very strong emphasis on academic study of the scriptures and a de-emphasizing of meditation. Back in the 19th century, there was a number of religious reforms, and they strongly encouraged a knowledge of Pali and a knowledge of the scriptures, and they didn't emphasize meditation, and actually actively discouraged it in many ways. So the revival of the forest tradition with the Venerable Ajahn Mun and his disciples, like Venerable Ajahn Chah, there was a distinct move in the opposite direction, saying, well, rather than spending all your time looking at the Pali language and the Dhamma books, then the most important thing is to train your heart, train your mind. And so it was almost like a revolution against that over-academic approach. And so It, say, was trying to give a voice to the meditation tradition and also the strict practice of the Vinaya discipline. So so this was the kind of background for Lumpur Sumedho and other elders of our tradition, the Westerners who arrived in the late 60s, early 70s, mid-70s. I showed up in 1978. So that was the standard form for the monastery. So you listen to the words of your teacher and say, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And so there was very little emphasis on any kind of study or say picking up the scriptures or getting familiar with the scriptures. Almost every Dhamma talk was the insight or the experience based on the practice of the acharya themselves, what they had done or what they'd understood or what they'd had to work with within their own minds. And there are very little references directly to the suttas. So that was the landscape of the Buddhist world that we grew up in. But what we found when the monasteries here in the UK were established, Lumpur Sumedho was invited to come to England in 1977 and ended up staying here. And then Chithurst Monastery, Chitta Viveka, was established in 1979. That as we sort of got settled and the community started to expand and more people came to visit us, there would often be questions about particular aspects of the Buddha's teaching, or people who had been practicing Buddhists or who had studied a lot of suttas, and they say, oh, I'm very interested in this particular passage in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, or there's this interesting word that the Buddha uses in the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta. Can you tell me about that? And so I was a very junior monk at that time, but even the elders would go, show me the passage that you mean. I don't know the word that you're talking about. That's not familiar to me. And over and over, we would find that we were really uneducated. And often the sort of old school Buddhists of Britain had a lot more knowledge of the scriptures and the teachings than us professional monastics did. So as we looked at this and reflected on this, we realized, well, within the forest tradition in Thailand, the way it had taken shape was that against a background of growing up in a Buddhist country and hearing Buddhist stories and studying Buddhism in school and hearing the teachings and the principles as the Four Noble Truths, the three characteristics of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, the qualities of the Eightfold Path, all of these would have been around be very much forming a part of the education, the spiritual, environment that everybody is growing up in, the stories of the life of the Buddha, the birth of the Buddha in the Sakyan kingdom, and then his going forth, and the establishment of the Sangha. Those stories would all be familiar, that there would be legends and tales that the parents would tell the children, or they'd hear when they went to the monastery and listened to Dhamma talks and so on. But as Westerners, none of us grew up with any of that. When you find someone who is a very dedicated and committed monk, and then somebody asks them, well, is this called the Eightfold Path? What are the eight things of the Eightfold Path? And then someone who's been in robes for 5 years is then struggling to come up with all eight, thinking, well, six and a half of the eight. And we realized, well, we should maybe make a bit more, not be so sort of rigid about not studying, but rather it might be a good idea to actually have the scriptures around and to draw upon them, to look into them, to get familiar with them. And for myself, particularly since started doing more teaching, I found that it was very, very important, useful to get to know the scriptures, and then you find that over time, that certain suttas, certain phrases the Buddha uses, certain patterns of teaching, the similes and the lists that the Buddha came up with are incredibly helpful in terms of clarifying your own understanding and also conveying the principles of Dhamma to other people. So in the West, our community in a way is a little bit more academic or draws more upon the suttas in our own languages or also in the original Pali. And it's on account of really needing to provide that quality of Buddhist education, if you like, within our own monastic family, because you don't get it growing up in the schools in Britain or in France or in Italy or in Australia or Germany or many other countries around the world. The education is very secularized and unless it's a Buddhist a country with a strong Buddhist tradition like Sri Lanka or Thailand or Myanmar or Laos or Cambodia nowadays, that those teachings are not going to be around. So I greatly appreciate this generous offer of the World Dipitaka Foundation, and I feel it's a very helpful gift for us. Earlier today, the community breakfast time, I was talking a little bit about the inspiring and the encouraging qualities of Lumpur Tun. He was sitting next to me, so wasn't quite sure whether he would be happy being praised in public, but he's not here this evening, so I thought I might say a bit more. He is the abbot of the fifth branch monastery of Wat Bapong, Wat Tham Sang Phet, which literally means the forest monastery of the cave of diamond light, because there's some caves on the monastery property. It's on a rocky hill, and there was a time when there was this mysterious diamond-hued bright light that emerged from around this cave on this property on a certain occasion, a certain time. And that's how it got its name. And he was one of the monks that Lumpur Cha gave responsibility to and saw as being someone who was very well established in the practice, very even-minded, very very fair, and very very committed, and a good teacher, a good practitioner. And also at his monastery, before the International Forest Monastery opened up in 1975, many many Westerners, Ajahn Chah would encourage the Westerners to go and stay with Lumpur Tun and to train with him. And so it was his monastery was one where Lumpur Sumato and many of the other early Western monastics stayed during the period of the early 70s. That it was almost a sort of the Western Forest Monastery before Wat Pananachat, the international monastery, began. Oh, some of the qualities I've been very inspired by in Lumpur Tun. He finished building his main temple, and they had a dedication ceremony in January, and so we invited him to come and spend some time here to rest up a bit and be in a different environment for a few months. And it's been very, very striking to me how, even though he's very senior, this is his, 57th or 58th Vasa Rains Retreat this year, so he's been a monk for a very, very long time. He never asks for any kind of special treatment. He never once made anything of being very senior. He's extraordinarily unneedy, so that I don't think he actually asked for anything, as far as I'm aware, the whole time he was here. And so you'd look out to take care of him and offer him what he might need, but he never asked for anything. You say, "Oh, Lumpur, it's a bit cold today. You know, have you got enough warm clothing? Do you need any socks, or can we offer you a hat?" And he's, "Oh, okay." But he wouldn't ask for anything. But also not in a "I'm not asking for anything" kind of uptight or a loaded way, but rather just completely at ease. So a quality of contentment, of santuti, is something that he is continually embodying, manifesting, and is very a very beautiful example. Also, in our monasteries in Thailand, they're in forests, and so there's daily chores of sweeping leaves off the paths to keep the paths clear. So, you know, Lumpur, even though we didn't ask him or expect him to be doing any physical work, he, of his own accord, he got himself a broom and would be sweeping leaves pretty much every single day, and to take that as part of his life. You know, you eat, you breathe, you sweep leaves. You know, it's part of the monastic form, and something he was very happy to give his time and energy and attention to. The that quality of being unneedy or not demanding, also not just from his own personal needs, but also there's a willingness and a readiness in him to adapt to different circumstances. So he not only did he never ask for anything, he never asked to go anywhere. If you invited him or said, "Oh, Lumpur, we'd like to take you to visit this branch monastery, or to go and visit this other elder, or to there's an invitation to this place," then he'd quite happily say, "Okay, very good, Sātu, yes, I can do that." But he never asked, "Can I go here? Can I go there? I'm really interested to see this or that." He was, again, this is quality of contentment, but also adaptability. So when he would go on an outing to visit a different monastery or someplace, then he'd be very engaged with that and very happy to be there and to be ready to sort of connect with the people and be pleased to be present. And if people wanted some teachings, he'd be very happy to give some Dhamma reflections and in a very sort of helpful and lucid way, very clear and helpful practical teachings. But he wasn't trying to be, you know, always teaching or feeling that he had to create a particular impression on people. So I felt that also as a very good example of if it's time to do something, you do it, and you do it wholeheartedly, and you engage. But there's no need to be doing anything. There's no, if you need to be a personality and to engage and to teach and to be offering advice, you can do that. But there's no, if the situation doesn't call for it, then he was completely at ease and not looking for any kind of activity or engagement or distraction. So there's no compulsiveness in him, which is again a very, very beautiful, very, very fine example, and the sense of adaptability, ready to adapt to circumstances, different situations, and to fit with the people that he was with and what was going on. And the phrase that came to mind was one that you come across in the suttas very regularly, as friendly and undisputing as milk with water. So that was an example the Buddha would use from time to time, say that milk and water mixed together with in a complete and an easy way. And so I felt that was very much how Lumpur Thun would operate, would just be like being able to harmonize with people, with situations, and in a very easy and relaxed and natural way, just like milk mixing with water. The quality of harmony and that sense of adaptability was very much a theme of Lumpur Cha's teaching, and so that a lot of his advice and guidance to the community, both at Wat Bopong or the many branch monasteries that he established, and then when he came over with Lumpur Sumedho in 1977, when he came back and visited again in 79, really throughout his teaching and the establishment of his different monasteries, different centers, the quality of harmony, samagi, concord, not just in the community, but also in the village, you know, helping, you know, wives and husbands to get along with each other, children and parents to get along with each other, different groups within a village or different villages. He was continually, say, focusing on how to establish samagi, how to establish concord, and recognizing that's really difficult. It's not something you can just decide to do, you know, to be harmonious. But it takes work and takes attention. But it was a theme. Again, if you listen to his talks or read many of the transcribed talks in Lumpo Cha's Dhamma books, over and over and over again, there's this reflections on the quality of concord, how beautiful and how powerful it is. And this is a recurrent theme also in the Buddha's teaching, how beautiful is the harmony of the Sangha. And so I feel it's one of the legacies that I found for myself from having Lumpo Tun around as a really good example is that quality of the basis of samagi or concord. I'm reflecting on this because it's in any group of people, whether it's if your sangha is only like two of you. If you're on a Tudong walk or you're just traveling together with one other person or you're living in a very small place, it can be demanding, difficult just to get on with one other person, let alone living with a big group of people in the monks' community or the nuns' community or as a lay resident or a lay guest here, or whether we're in your own home, in your own family. Establishing concord is tough. It's hard work. It's not just something that you can have as an ideal or as an aspiration and just make it happen. You get a magnet for your fridge that says, let's all live in harmony. Ding! And harmony is established. It's not that easy. So it's good to consider, to reflect on what are the things that divide us, or what are the ways that we can work with the experiences of disharmony or alienation or feelings of separateness or disconnection, and how can we work with those, and how can we use our living experience to establish that quality of harmony and living together with each other, as friendly and undisputing as milk with water. How can we establish that quality of adaptability and attunement? Now, firstly, one of the things that comes to mind, I was talking with one of the monks today, is when we meet with friction or difficulty, when we're worried about our relationship, if we've had a friendship and it's broken down, or somebody intimidates us and we feel afraid of them, or somebody is annoying, we feel critical of them, or someone's got a very strong opinion and that they're really keen we see things very differently. Yeah. Then when there's that kind of conflict or difficulty or alienation, that feeling of separation, one of the most common feelings, certainly for myself, is to get away from that, what they call being conflict aversive. So I feel that I was a real expert in conflict avoidance, conflict aversion, aversiveness, particularly as a younger person, and my early times in the Sangha, I was really just very, very worried about any kind of disharmony and or disconnection, and was always trying to make everything right and to make everybody happy and get everything in a comfortable and good way. And so I found any kind of friction or alienation, difficulty, very, very distressing. But when I would be mindful enough to notice that, I would recollect the teaching that Lumpo Cha gave when Lumpo Sumedho made his first visit back to Thailand after Chidhurst Monastery had been established, and in 1981, early 1981, Lumpo Sumedho went back to visit Thailand, and Ajahn Chah asked him, "So Sumedho, you've got this new monastery, Chidhurst, you know, how's it going there? And Lumpur Sumedho tells this story very often. He said, oh, it's amazing. You know, I've never lived with such a very impressive group of people. You know, the monks are already committed, and there's this group of four women who've taken the eight precepts, and they're very diligent, and they work very hard to get along with each other, and everyone's, say, very personally motivated, and they are committed to the practice. I've never lived with such an inspiring and impressive group of people ever in my life before. And so he's, as they say, waxing lyrically, and you know, getting very enthusiastic about this wonderful, amazing, incredible, wonderful, inspiring group of people that he's living with. And Lumpur Cha's response was, you won't develop any wisdom living with that lot. Completely unimpressed. Absolutely the opposite to the reaction that Lumpur Sumedho thought he was going to get. You know, he assumed that Lumpur Cha would say, oh, well, that's great, Sumedho. You know, you must be doing a wonderful job teaching everyone. And so, sātu, sātu, well done. This is great. I'm glad to hear it. It was the opposite. It was that it's through friction and difficulty, through feeling worried, through feeling alienated, feeling insecure, feeling irritated, feeling kind of, say, distressed. That friction is the very way that we sharpen our wisdom. That's how, as he would say, that's the very means whereby we sharpen the blade of the wisdom sword. The edge of your wisdom becomes keen. So I over the years I've reflected on that teaching a lot. I've mentioned it many times in Dhamma talks because I use it a lot. It's extraordinarily helpful because something in us that we don't like to be worried. We don't like to be lost or alone. We don't like to be insecure or to be irritated or to be kind of pressured. We want to get away from that. We want to get away from that those uncomfortable, difficult, burdensome, stressful states. That's our conditioning. That's our natural inheritance as a living being. We get away from what is stressful and difficult and get to a place that's comfortable, the fear gets us away from the dangerous situation. So it's very natural to pull away from that. So this advice from Lumpur Cha to actually turn towards it and say, aha, interesting. Capital I, interesting. Oh, how am I going to handle this one? Or how does this? Or what are we going to do about this? This is a really impossible puzzle. Okay, and I find that for myself, you have to very consciously go against that sort of get away from this and find a comfortable place and say, okay, now this is exactly what I didn't want to happen. This is a really challenging situation. This person is really upset with me, or this person is really, you know, lost, or very worried, or very lonely. Rather than pushing that away, or trying to escape from it, or wait for it, you know, for the contact to be over so you can get away and not have to think about it, the encouragement is to turn towards it and say, aha. So what can be learned from this? How can this be received? How can this be something that is used to brighten, to sharpen the quality of wisdom? That the friction of that feeling of difficulty, even though it's something that we would never choose, or that we're not deliberately making problems for ourselves, or not deliberately making other people frightening to us or distressing to us. We're not deliberately causing ourselves problems, but we're consciously turning the attention towards that very difficulty and changing the attitude towards it, so that just as Lumpur Cha did with Lumpur Sumedho, so, you know, this is not to be, say, rejoice when there's no friction, but rather When there is friction, when there is difficulty, when there are these challenges, we steadily turn and gently, firmly turn our attention towards them. But also, you know, when you use a grindstone, when you're actually sharpening a blade, like sharpening a chisel or something, sharpening a knife with a grindstone, you have to get the angle right, and you have to get the pressure right. Otherwise, you know, you break the blade, or you put a big notch in it, or if you don't press hard enough, it doesn't make it sharp, or you press in the wrong way, then it comes out uneven. So you have to get the the angle right, you have to get the pressure right, and then this is what we learn over time in living in community, working with our family life, our monastic companions, and living in the workplace. We learn how to apply that pressure in the skillful way, to get the angle right, to get the pressure right, and so that we can actively learn how to use the stresses, the tensions, the fears, and the frictions of living with each other as a way to develop wisdom, to really open the heart to the situation and to learn from it in a conscious and active way. And we're also reflecting on this and what causes, say, division or alienation from each other. A lot of it, many, many different ways you can look at this or consider it. But I feel that one of the root causes of disharmony or division, when we feel ourselves alienated from each other or critical of each other, it's even though our attention might go out to another person, also not just in a negative way, but also if we are, say, very attached to that person, that we've got a particular friend that we feel we've got to be close to, or that we need to have them around, that even though the attention might be going out to other people, the source of it can be our own hunger for defined being. You know, in the Pali, this is called bhava tanha, the desire for existence, the desire to be that. You translate it into English into a variety of different ways, but I feel that hunger for defined being something. I want to be something. I need to be somebody. That is often driving the conflict or the difficulty or the sources of disharmony or disconnection within the community, the feelings of jealousy or irritation or anxiety or obsession. Even though the attention is going outwards, the fuel for it can be my need to be something, so that even though we might be afraid of somebody else or worried about someone else, that feeling of me worrying is actually what the heart is hanging on to. There's a me who's worrying, a me who's annoyed, a me who's in love, or a me who's got something to do, me who's got this role. So if we look at this, that hunger for defined being, this is, even though it's a bit of an unusual phrase in English, I feel it's important to look at that, and to because sometimes we say we have a difficulty or a problem, we have a conflict with someone, and we get annoyed with someone. And that even though the attention goes out to the other person, actually what's, say, fueling that or keeping that alive can be the sense of identity that we get from being someone who is annoyed, or someone who is obsessed, or someone who is anxious. And for myself, I feel that it takes a lot of effort to turn the attention around, rather than than the mind going on to the thing that we are worried about, the situation, or what do we do about this, or this is a big project, or oh, I'm responsible for this, I'm supposed to be the work monk or the work nun, or I'm supposed to be looking after the guests, or I have to take care of the kitchen, or the library, it's got my name on it, what am I going to do? That even though we might think I'm burdened or I'm stressed by this particular situation or this particular responsibility, something in us is actually relishing that feeling of, this is my problem. my anger with this particular person or my regret about that terrible thing that I did that I can't be forgiven for. I hope that people can get a sense of what I'm talking about here, because I feel if we can turn the attention back to the attitude that the mind brings, it's very revealing. That sometimes we think, well, I don't want that fear, or I don't want that longing, or I don't want that conflict. Part of us does. Part of us actually loves that sense of me who's got a problem, me who is somebody, me who's done this unforgivable thing, me who's got this great potential, me who's got this enemy, me who's got this person that I'm jealous of. And that the effort needs to be like a 180-degree turn to bring the attention to that, to recognize that hungering for the sense of I and me and mine, what the Buddha called ahankara, I-making, mamankara, mind-making. And this is really what the insight meditation is designed to do, is to help turn the attention around, to bring the vision inwards, to turn the vision towards the heart, to recognize those I-making and mind-making attitudes. Because the more, at least in my experience of community life and living in the world, the more that the mind is feeding and sustaining that I and me and mine, the ahankara, mamankara, then the more that we find ourselves alienated, we find ourselves being lonely or jealous of people or obsessed with people, in love with people, or irritated by people, or afraid of people. The more there's a me, a solid I here, then the more there's the other. And so that it's a mysterious thing, but the best way to establish harmony between yourself and others is to let go of yourself, to recognize those I-making and mind-making habits, that the addiction of the heart to bhava-tanha, to that quality of defined being, and to recognize that and to let go of that. To reflect on this area also, I feel it's helpful to consider perceptions, the way that we frame the world. In the Pali Canon, one of the suttas contained in the text that I've been reflecting on and using a lot in the last year or two is sutta number 116 in section 35 of the Connected Discourses. So it's the Connected Discourses about the six senses, the Salayatanavaga, and it's sutta 116. And in that sutta, then the Buddha says that whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world, that's what we call the world in this Dhamma and discipline. And what is it whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world? The eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. So that's, again, a bit of a stylized way of speaking. But what that means is that we don't experience the world, but we experience our mind's version of the world. And so for most of us, again, like not noticing the attachment to I and me and mine, and the hungering to be, the hunger for defined being, and the fear of undefined being, most of us, most of the time, don't recognize that our perceptions are constructed, that they are formed, that we see what we expect to see, or we see according to our own conditioning. We are assuming that we're experiencing reality. So, like this evening, so we don't usually have this table full of books here. And so I arrived here in the temple and got to my seat, and it was 7:29 and 20 seconds. So I thought, oh, it's nearly time to ring the bell. So I bowed three times, and it was 7:29 and sort of 55 seconds. So I rang the bell, and then this morning when we had our recitation of the monk's rule, then the candles and the incense were on the shrine in the usual place. So I rang the bell and then went forward, and then, oh, no candles. Oh, no incense. So I didn't actually see the candles and the incense in front of the table there. I did not see them. There was, and it wasn't until Sister Nyanasiri said, "They're in front of the table, Ajahn." Oh, then I came back and, oh, look at that, there they are. So we see what we expect to see. I wasn't expecting to see the incense burner and the candles in front, so my eye didn't pick it up. It was didn't catch my attention, so it wasn't there. Though I feel that it's extremely helpful to recognize, to continually reflect, over and over, many, many times a day, that what we perceive is conditioned, it's constructed, it's not the world, it's our mind's version of the world. And so that the judgments that the mind makes, saying this is good, that's bad, this is right, that's wrong, this is beautiful, that's ugly, we take those to be absolutely true. Speaking from personal experience, that we assume, I call this beautiful, it is beautiful. I call this ugly, it's ugly. I call this right, it is right. I call that wrong, it is wrong. But if we believe the judgments of the mind, then and we don't recognize the conditioned and fabricated nature of perception, then again, that is a major cause for conflict. Because if I can, if I think that what I see and the judgment that my mind makes is true, then if you see it differently, then you're wrong. There's division between us. But if there can be the recognition, oh, that's this mind's perception of things, that it's seeing it this way, then there's much more space to recognize, well, of course, others are going to see it differently. How could it be the same? I remember this morning I was talking about the beautiful flower arrangements that have been created for the offering ceremony, and how we might look at them and go, oh, wow, those are so beautiful. I said, wow, that's amazing, how glorious, how lovely, how wonderful. But if you're allergic to the pollen from the, or the smell of the lilies, you go, oh no, not those lilies, I can't bear it. Ah, how can I escape? And so the experience is very different. Or it might be that you are in charge of the flower arranging, and that when you see the beautiful arrangements that Yom Sarah put together with her team for this ceremony, they go, oh, I can never be that good. I'm useless. I'm a failure. My life is a complete waste. You know, I can never be that good. What's the point of even trying? You know, it's all useless. I'm a failure. And so, what one person sees as beautiful and inspiring, someone else sees as an example of how useless they are, or how they can never be that good. And so, is it beautiful, or is it not? Is it a cause of inspiration, or is it a cause of desperation? What is it? So I feel, and I say this over and over again, but I do strongly encourage this, because we are so strongly conditioned to believe our opinions. When we call something wrong, it shouldn't be that way. That's the wrong place to put it. or rightness. Or this is right. This is good. This is exactly how it should be. This is good. This is right. We believe in those judgments. This is right. That's wrong. And the more that the mind takes that as an absolute truth, the more we create the causes of suffering. We create alienation, insecurity. We create division and dukkha, in short. And so that one of the practices that I like to do when you have that experience of say the mind saying this is right, to consciously bring that into the heart, to strengthen that. When you're attached to some particular point of view, or you think something is good and right, yes, this is right, it should be this way, to actually explore that feeling of rightness and then its partner wrongness. This is wrong, it shouldn't be this way, that's bad. And so if the mind has latched on to some particular experience or something that we see or hear or something that we do or something, there's that sense of approval and say, this is right, this is how it should be, this is good. To bring that into awareness and to consciously think those words, this is right. This is right. This is right. And when we bring that into the heart, fully aware of it, then at that moment when there is that full reception, bringing that judgment of rightness, or like say the ceremony that we had yesterday, that was beautiful, that was good, that was perfect. To take that feeling of rightness, that goodness, that sort of perfection, and just explore that. And without any kind of big commentary, what happens is that the wisdom of the heart recognizes, well, it can only be right or good to a certain extent. They can't be absolute. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory. So it is impossible. It cannot be that this condition, this particular ceremony or this particular object, this particular thing, is absolutely right and good. It can't be, because it has to be unsatisfactory. That's the way all things are. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. All conditioned things are necessarily, by their conditioned nature, necessarily unsatisfactory. If you follow the Buddha's teaching, anyway. So that recognition of, oh, this feeling of rightness or goodness, it can only be part of the story. It can only be relative. Aha. And so we're not suppressing our feeling, we're not negating it, but we're just seeing it within a context. Similarly, when something is wrong, or like yesterday when they were trying to play the artificially, intelligently generated Pali chanting, and it wouldn't generate either artificially or not. It couldn't get it to work. So, for those of us who are not particularly attached or identified with getting that sound to appear, it's just, okay, it's just quiet, waiting for something to happen, nothing's happening. But if you're the person who's trying to make it work, it's like, oh, this is terrible, I'm so sorry, I apologize, you know, we should have this, it's not here, please excuse me. It's perceived in a very different way. So, just to say, take that feeling of wrongness. See, it's just in the same way you hear something, or you see something, or you remember something, or you the mind judges a particular event or a particular experience. It says that's wrong. It shouldn't be that way. That's wrong. And the natural patterns of perception that we have, the habits of attitude, are to take that to be something absolute, that is wrong, it shouldn't be that way, that's bad. And to, again, without suppression, without denying it or making any kind of comment, just bring the attention to that experience and just reflect on that feeling of wrongness. This is the experience of wrongness. That wrong feeling arises, passes away, just like the right feeling arises and passes away. The feeling of rightness, the feeling of wrongness. They are feelings. They are patterns of perception. They arise, they pass away. And if there can be developed a skillful attitude towards rightness and wrongness, and good and bad, beautiful, ugly, and so on and so forth, then there is we find a lot more space in our lives, in our hearts. There's a quality of freedom, a quality of ease. And that things are being seen in the light of Dhamma, in the context of Dhamma. Now, when I talk in this way, I also I find that people then will say misunderstand this or take it to mean that, okay, so we're not supposed to decide anything? We're not supposed to do anything? Or we're not supposed to... what are all these precepts if there's no right and wrong? What are all these rules that we have to live by? You know? And so it seems to be contradictory. But this is, it's what we're doing with this is not, say, ignoring the fact that, say, skillful speech and kindly attitudes bring pleasant wholesome results, and unskillful speech and unskillful, unfriendly, unkind, cruel attitudes bring painful results. Yes, they do. But what this is talking about is developing a clearer perspective to see things in their true light. So this is what I would call wise discrimination. So in the Eightfold Path, the first two elements are right view and right, usually translated as right thought or right intention, right resolution. Samma Sankappo, like in the Dhammacakka Sutta, we chanted that. Samma Ditti, Samma Sankappo. So particularly Samma Sankappo, the second one, this is gets overlooked quite often in descriptions of the path. But this, I feel, is a particularly significant area, because this is about wise discrimination. So the ability of the heart to recognize, oh, this is a skillful thought, this is an unskillful thought. This is the attitude that, say, is attaching to rightness and wrongness, and it doesn't have to do that. So that sama, when that sankappo, that resolution, or that intention, that thinking, that attitude, that capacity to discriminate or to choose, when that is samma, when it's in tune with Dhamma, then the mind can recognize, well, this is out of balance, or this looks, this is unskillful, or this is inappropriate, this is something that is going to be harmful, then without attaching to it or reacting to it in a blind way, then the other aspects of the path, in terms of speech, in terms of action, and so forth, they arise from that wise attunement, that wise discrimination. It's in tune with Dhamma, so it's not coming from a place of ego or reactivity. It's recognizing, oh, this is a judgment based on an unwholesome quality, therefore leave it aside, don't follow it. This is a judgment that's based on a wholesome quality, it's based on kindness and unselfishness, friendliness, therefore it's something that is to be acted upon. So when we talk about letting go or not attaching to right and wrong, it doesn't mean being numb or switched off or just spaced out. It's not a discarding of appropriate conduct, but rather it's learning how to act and speak from a place of selflessness, to let that wise discrimination really be cultivated, and so that there's a feeling of rightness or goodness, and then with the wise attunement, wise discrimination, then the appropriate way to act on it, what to say, what to not say, what to do, what to not do, that arises from that wise discrimination, that wise attunement to the time, the place, the situation. So this quality of, say, non-attachment or non-identification with right and wrong, it's not a dismissal of those, but really learning how to use those impressions of this is right, this is wrong, this is beautiful, this is ugly, this is say wholesome or unwholesome, to use those without confusion, to apply those without attachment and identification, then the results can be very, very beneficial. So that when we say, oh, this is really good, this is really wonderful, this is inspiring, this is great, then there isn't that attachment or identification. There's not a grasping of it, but rather, this is a wholesome thing. This is my mind's impression of this is something beautiful, inspiring. Let's not assume that everyone else sees it the same way. It's beautiful and inspiring here, but that might not be the same for everyone. Aha! Similarly, someone's action might be, frightening or, upsetting or confusing or, irritating. Oh, yeah, how can he do that? This is really annoying or this is really intimidating. This guy is really big. Doesn't he know how worrying, how intimidating his presence is? How can he be that way and not realize he's frightening me? To recognize, well, this is what my mind is creating. It's generating this feeling of intimidation. That person might have no intention to intimidate, no awareness that they're causing anxiety or fear in me. But so my experience is painful or difficult, but it's not necessarily something that is intended or is coming from another person because they want to, so that we are able to respond to situations, to the people that we live with, the people that we work with, the people that we meet on the street. We can respond rather than react. I feel that if we are able to cultivate these qualities of ways to work with disharmony or alienation, discord, then we can develop the skills to genuinely live in harmony, to genuinely blend with each other as friendly and undisputing as milk with water. It doesn't mean that we'll like everybody that we live with, that everyone that is there in the working in the office or in the workplace, in the home or in the monastery. It doesn't mean that we like everybody or find every encounter comfortable or easy, but what it means is that we are able to work with, we can cultivate a skillful attitude regardless of whether we're comfortable or uncomfortable, whether the person that we're working with, who's in the next cubicle in the office, whether we understand them or don't understand them, whether we find them easy to get on with or difficult to get on with, we find that capacity to attune and to learn from every situation, just like Lumpur Cha's comment to Lumpur Sumedho, that you won't learn anything from that lot. When we are meeting with difficulty or conflict or anxiety and stress, that if we wish to practice the Dhamma, if we really want to make the most of the opportunities we have in our life, then there's a cultivation of that turning of the heart to to meet the situation, to receive it, to acknowledge it, and to work with it in a way that is in accordance with Dhamma, so that if something needs to be said, it can be said. If things need to be left alone, then we leave them alone. And that those responses, they come from the heart's own attunement to the reality of the present experience. So I offer these words for consideration this evening. Sadhu.